WJF.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with a Tampa man who's now working in Uganda to improve medical delivery. And we'll talk about some of the recent shakeups in Florida politics, about a major investigative report into the lavish spending habits of one of the most powerful politicians in Tallahassee, when we hear an edition of Florida This Week later on. And we'll also open up the phone lines during this hour. But first, one listener comment about last Friday's show. Last Friday, the topic of Al Franken's resignation from the U.S. Senate again came up. Here's what one listener had to say.
This is Mike from Sarasota, and I am responding to your show on Friday. I think that given the current situation where we are allowing allegations without real proof to destroy the careers of politicians, that nefarious forces are using this climate to get rid of liberal and moderate politicians. One example, Al Franken, who has not been proven guilty of anything, but who had to resign under immense pressure from other Democrats, given the level of hysteria about the sexual harassment situation. For another example, Jack Latvala, senator from Pinellas County, who was the moderate gubernatorial candidate in a field of hard-right Republicans. Because there were three running against him, we might have had a chance to finally get a moderate Republican governor, certainly a moderate Republican to be the nominee for the Republican Party, and if it succeeded, likely we could have had a moderate Republican governor. But that didn't happen, because in Matt Vallow's case, during the campaign, suddenly accusations from six anonymous sources emerged. Question, who organized his accusations? Then, later on, it turned into accusations from a legislative aide, Rachel Perrin Rogers, whose husband, guess what, is a longtime operative for far-right Republicans. Then there were accusations from another anonymous source. By any standard of proof, these accusations lack credibility. Because of the sexual harassment situation where due process and real proof is not being used to destroy politicians, that situation is being used by the right wing to get rid of liberal and moderate politicians.
Well, that was a comment about last Friday's show. Our first guest today on Radioactivity is Kevin Gibbons. He's the executive director of the nonprofit organization Health Access Connect, which provides healthcare access to people living in remote villages in Uganda. Health Access uses motorcycle taxis to set up monthly health clinics in remote villages in that country. These clinics allow people to access essential health services like antiretroviral treatment, malaria treatment, child checkups, and family planning. And Kevin Gibbons, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much, Rob. Nice to be here.
So tell me, who came up with this idea to do this?
I was there when I went to University of Wisconsin in Madison for my graduate studies. And so I went to do research mostly on sort of fisheries and livelihoods in these Lake Victoria villages. And as I was there, what people kept talking about was lack of social services, lack of healthcare. And it kept coming up something, you know, I was just sort of asking about people's livelihoods as it related to fisheries management. And someone would point to a neighbor next door and say, you know, that person died over there of HIV, and free healthcare is 3 miles away. And so that, you know, that excited, you know, that was, first of all, extremely tragic, but also seemed like a solvable problem, something you could address. Hey, it's there, you know, the healthcare is there. How do we connect it to people living in remote areas? And so it started like that, talked to a few people I was working with and a few Ugandan friends and said, could we set up a delivery service? Could we do something like that? And it has sort of blossomed and changed from there.
Uganda is in the center part of Africa?
Yeah, it's sort of eastern Africa. If you know where kind of Kenya and Tanzania is, they're all on Lake Victoria right there and sort of central eastern.
It's landlocked.
That's right.
South of Sudan.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And tell me the level of development that is taking place, because when I think of Kenya, I think that's probably one of the most developed parts of Africa. I don't know if that's real, but I've had friends going there since the 70s.
Mm-hmm. I think Kenya, I don't know about development indicators and things. You know, South Africa is probably one of the more developed, and some North African countries, at least Egypt had been. I don't know how that's changed over time. And then, yeah, Kenya has a big sort of tech and startup culture in Nairobi and a lot of sort of economic activity.
And what's the status of Uganda?
Uganda is doing well, you know. It's been stable for a while. There's been investment. You know, I live in Kampala with my family, my daughter and my baby. And, you know, it's bustling. There's a lot of traffic. There seem to be new businesses going up all the time. So it's not skyrocketing in terms of economic development, and there's still potholes sort of everywhere. But, you know, you get the idea, it's doing pretty well.
Is it still a agriculture-based economy?
Yeah, majority is agriculture. I think some of the major exports are coffee. Fish is a major export from Lake Victoria. And, yeah, mostly agricultural products, sugar, bananas, things like that.
So 3 miles away, there's medical help, but for some reason people can't, that 3 miles is hard to maneuver. I take it the roads are pretty bad.
Yeah, in these areas the roads are bad, and the majority of people take a motorcycle taxi to get anywhere. So if you're a pregnant woman and you're having a troubled birth, or you go into labor right away, you might have to jump on a motorcycle to take an hour long motorcycle ride, which shouldn't happen. And the same thing, if you're feeling sick, then you might have to take that motorcycle ride. For a lot of people, the problem we were initially trying to address was, you live with HIV, you have to take these you pick up your drugs on a monthly basis, and you take a daily drug regimen and keeps you alive. You lived a long age. But you have to then go to the facility every month. And if that costs $3 or $10 round trip each time, that's too much for people. And people end up not going to seek health services because they're not readily available.
So you bring the healthcare to them.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, the way I think of it sometimes is, well, instead of waiting for people to go to the facility, you bring the facility to them on a monthly basis. So you know, every few weeks, you know, the health workers are going to come. You can take your child to get a checkup. You can, vaccinations, antiretroviral treatment, family planning, prenatal checkup, all those sort of essential rural health services, things that are available in droves around here, but are just difficult to access. So that's what we try to do and sort of maintain it on that monthly basis.
I picture somebody on a motorcycle, a healthcare worker on a motorcycle carrying a big box behind them and driving into these towns, the rural villages in Uganda every month.
Well, the way we do it, two things that are kind of different about what we do and, you know, what has attracted interest in the way that we're doing it are, one is we use microfinance motorcycle taxis. So the major form of transportation is these motorcycle taxis. So what we do is, instead of purchasing a motorcycle that sits at a health facility, in a lot of sort of development and charity projects, that people, you know, purchase a lot of vehicles and they just sort of sit idle most of the time. So we thought, well, there's a lot of demand for having a motorcycle taxi. We'll give a loan to somebody who lives in one of the communities we'd like to serve. Very, you know, good, low interest loan. He pays it off. 27 days out of the month, he runs his business.
So he runs a taxi business.
He runs his taxi business, but 3 days as part of the loan, 3 days per month, he hits their three villages. So three, and with monthly clinics. So 3 days per month, he's at the beck and call of those health workers for that day, and he's only given money for his fuel. So it's sort of a sacrifice for him, but the terms of the loan make it sort of desirable.
So you set up these small business people who have their own taxi business on the motorcycles, but they have to give three mm-hmm. days a month back mm-hmm. to the community.
That's right.
Huh.
Yeah, and it's kind of a condition of the loan. And I think one thing I really like about that is it gives people access who would never have access to credit or wouldn't have access to, you know, a low interest loan, access to that small business rather than what most motorcycle taxi drivers do, which is sort of rent a motorcycle from someone, and then after a couple of years, you know, it could just disappear. Who knows, you know? And so it gives that person access, and it's also a working vehicle, you know? And that vehicle, they get a lot of mileage on those motorcycle taxis. And at the end of 18 months of payment, we get money that we can then go and get another motorcycle and set it up. So that, you know, another person gets the loan.
So after 18 months, they own their own motorcycle.
That's right. We sign over the title and, you know, our contract's done. If they want to continue to run that service, we can give them a retainer. We can help. But otherwise, you know, they're no longer obligated to sort of run those clinics.
It's a way to be entrepreneurial and also serve the community at the same time.
Yeah, and you find these guys, it's mostly men. It's 100% men run motorcycle taxi businesses. That's just how it is. These guys go in thinking, well, it's kind of a pain, but this is a sweet deal, so I'll go with it. And then they find after a while that people really appreciate their work and trust them. People take down their cell phone numbers and call them when they need a ride. You know, I think it feels good to people. You know, hey, I'm doing a service to these villages and to where I live. But it also builds trust and status within the community in some way.
Well, we're talking with Kevin Gibbons. He's the executive director of the nonprofit organization Health Access Connect, which provides healthcare access to people living in remote villages in the country of Uganda in Central Africa. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So are these motorcycle trips scheduled every month? People know what day of the month the motorcycle is coming to their village?
Yeah, the health workers, you know, our bit is just kind of the logistic bit. So the health workers tell us and tell the community, hey, we're going to be there on the 26th this month. Next month, we're going to be back on the 24th, XYZ. It usually corresponds with a certain day of the week. And then we help to make sure that the community knows what's going on. Usually there's one thing we learned is we had low attendance at first. We're like, well, no, people don't know about it. So we bought megaphones for $4 for each village. And you have somebody running around, hey, they're coming. Doctors are coming. They're going to give out these services. Which is kind of fun to watch. You know, somebody just sort of walking down the street yelling about what services are coming. But that, you know, doubled attendance, if not more, after a while, because people knew about it and they understood what they had access to. And
so people line up then on these days of the month?
Yeah, the average, you know, we collect data on each clinic. The average number of patients is 51. About 26 of those patients come to get antiretroviral treatment. About 30% are children that come for checkups and vaccines and things like that. We're trying, you know, the past few months and this year, we're trying to add to the maternal and child health services. So more prenatal visits, which is a problem in the country. Women are, you might get them once or twice rather than the four times you'd like to have them. Also encourage them to give birth in the facility, help them come up with a birth plan, do postnatal checkups, those kind of services. And family planning. There's a lot of demand for family planning, but it's difficult for people to get access to those services. So we're trying to kind of respond to what our partners in the villages are telling us. Hey, we'd like these services.
What happens if a healthcare worker notices something more serious, like a heart problem or cancer or you know, some major problem with the pregnancy?
Yeah, great question. It's hard to say. They could recommend, hey, you should take a motorcycle. And some patients, they would take that day. You know, usually it's 3 to 5 health workers who go. The motorcycle makes usually at least 2 trips to drop them off. So you could say, hey, let's go back to the facility together. Or come back another day. You know, this is not something we can do here. But recently what we've done is we've purchased these, we're really excited about it, motorcycle ambulance trailers. So what does that mean? You know, I have a vague picture in my head. You know, I've seen them, and I still have a vague picture in my head over there. But they are, think of a trailer that like they have those bike trailers here that people put behind, and you can tow a child or something like that. So it's like that, but bigger. It tows a, you know, a grown human being and who sits at kind of a 45-degree angle, sort of reclined, and, you know, latches that to the back of the motorcycle, and you can take them to a facility. So if somebody has an emergency, like they're in labor or they've broken a leg or they're unconscious, we're providing facilities these, because it's ambulance or emergency medical transportation is just totally unavailable in a lot of places where we work. Or there's an ambulance, but it's never available, or people can't afford to buy fuel for it. So these are available, and they use the network and the motorcycles that are already there. So that's, we're just going to start that this year. And we're looking forward to sort of seeing how much those get used. Because in between, that's, okay, you do this thing every month. There are a lot of services that are not a monthly type of thing.
So how do you support this? How do you support this?
Yeah, good question. You know, end of the year fundraising drives, like right now. And we got a grant earlier this year from a foundation that supports sort of innovative health, you know, global health solutions. So this year we're collecting donations. You can go to healthaccessconnect.org or healthaccessconnect.org and donate our website. We have a 501c3. Your donations are, at least for now, 100% tax deductible. And so we, you know, those donations go a long way.
You're kind of foreshadowing the Trump tax plan that's going to come through.
Yeah,
I'm worried about that.
I'm a little unclear. I know that it hasn't totally removed the tax deductibility of donations, but I think there were some provisions that were removed, and I struggled to understand the different versions of what finally was passed and came out, which is one of the problems with how it was passed. But that affects us in a big way, and the whole nonprofit sector in a big way. You know, our tax code in the U.S. is structured to pass off a lot of social services locally and internationally to nonprofit organizations.
And charities. Yeah.
Right, and charities. We depend on that, and, you know, people in need depend on that as well. And that's hopefully that's not going to change a whole lot for organizations like ours that work in the U.S. and abroad and really depend on that philanthropy in the U.S.
Yeah, because if the tax break for charitable donations is diminished under this tax code, what happens to those charities? It's a big question, right? Hey, so Kevin, I want to ask you, I take it that you went there as a biologist.
Mm.
Were you a biology major there when you went to University of Wisconsin?
I was majoring in conservation biology and sustainable development. I was in the Peace Corps in the Philippines, and so I had this interest, and my background was in ecology, so I had this interest in conservation and how it relates to people, and especially people in remote communities, because that's where I had experience, you know, and interest in working. But I think, you know, morally and ethically, I think development and, business and aid and charity should depend on local perspectives and what people, you know, are in value in their everyday lives. So when I was talking about conservation and all these other things, and people were like, you know, healthcare, essential needs, essential services, it takes a little while for your mind to sort of, I think of myself as a conservationist, but now we're doing this health stuff. But over time, it becomes obvious, hey, this is what people are saying. This is something we should work on. I feel so fortunate to be able to do this kind of work and be able to, you know, make somewhat of a living off of, you know, helping people, trying to make some kind of difference in a way that is not a white savior type of way. Hey, I'm just, you know, going in as an outsider, a foreigner, a white person, trying to save people in this community, in this village.
What's the mechanism by which you connect to the people to find out what they need and what they want?
So in the beginning, it was us going, talking to people about having this idea for a kind of delivery service or these clinics. Right now, we the majority of the work that we do, because we don't hire the health workers, you know, we're just connecting to people. They're already a national health system. We spend a lot of our staff and to a certain extent, now less so me, but I still go there a lot, ask people what they think of the clinics, how they're going, what additional services they'd have. We have to talk to health workers a lot, because in some ways our direct beneficiaries are Ugandan health workers who want to be giving out, you know, have difficulty reaching certain patients over here, or know that they're having trouble meeting these health outcomes that they'd like to meet. And so we troubleshoot with them. Okay, well, how can we reach these target populations that you have? And so I think that back and forth and defining our role into just meeting that logistical need, you know, that need that's not being met by any other organization right now, that helps kind of target where we focus our efforts.
So if people want to help out, if they want to help out, again, the website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, healthaccessconnect.org. healthaccessconnect.org/donate if you want to donate. We're always looking for partners, people interested in volunteering or donating, donating and donating their time, and any feedback you have. What we're also trying to do is connect to more family foundations and corporate social responsibility programs, you know, places where a company would give matching donations and that kind of thing. So if anyone has some advice on, you know, how I'm giving my pitch in this radio show, or some people who might be interested in working with us and sort of helping us improve the way we're serving people, I'd love to, you know, get people's advice from that.
All right. Well, Kevin Gibbons, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Great to see you again.
Thanks so much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
All right. Good luck in going back to Africa.
Yes, thank you so
How
much.
How soon do you leave?
We're here until January 17th. So we get a good, nice month home with family, and then, yeah, we'll go back. And also, not a whole lot gets done in December and January in Uganda. So when in past years we stay there, oh, I'm going to be working, go out in these villages, talk to, you know, meet all these deadlines, and people take it off.
For
Christmas and New Year holidays. Yeah, and it's a majority Christian country, so really people are off for Christmas and New Year's.
They celebrate it, right?
They do. They do. A lot of chicken gets eaten.
Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Right now, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. Coming up next, veteran state senator Jack Latvala resigns. The Florida House Speaker is spending big money on meals, planes, and cufflinks. The GOP tax plan, will it help the economy? Our U.S. senators are split on that issue. And 200,000 new Puerto Rican residents have arrived here in Florida. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are Adam Smith is the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Ed Narain is a lawyer and a former member of the Florida House of Representatives and a Democrat. Amy Holyfield is deputy managing editor for politics and business at the Tampa Bay Times. And Danny Alvarez is an attorney and a business owner and a Republican. Thanks for coming. Great to see you. Well, he was once one of the most powerful legislators in Tallahassee. Clearwater Republican State Senator Jack Latvala resigned this week, one day after an investigation found credible evidence of sexual misconduct. In resigning, Latvala continued to deny doing anything wrong. The resignation came hours after Republican Governor Rick Scott and Attorney General Pam Bondi said he should step down. Latvala criticized calls for his resignation and said he no longer wants to serve with party leaders who did not allow him a chance to defend himself. A Senate investigation found it is likely Latvala inappropriately touched a top Senate aide. The report detailed accounts from a former lobbyist who said Latvala offered to support legislation in exchange for sex acts. The Senate handed over the report to law enforcement for a possible criminal investigation. Amy, let's start with the investigation itself. How devastating were the reports that came out this week about Latvala?
I'd say they were very devastating. If you read the 33-page report from the special master and the, I think, 17-page report from the other investigation, it's incredibly damning. They talked to so many people. They've got FDLE records. This clear in a short amount of time. They made a lot of ground doing an investigation that shows a very consistent pattern of really awful behavior.
Because Latvala was pretty defiant in his resignation. He didn't really accept any responsibility. He didn't apologize. He was mad at his fellow party members.
Yeah, that letter is some good reading in and of itself, because it is, I mean, we're living in an extraordinary time right now of all these accusations, and they're sweeping through every industry in our country. And so here, this is Tallahassee's version of the Me Too movement, and in the face of really unequivocal, damning evidence, State Senator Latvala was defiant mm-hmm. in his letter, and certainly not apologetic to the behavior that was found.
Ed, you served in the legislature. How would you describe the position that Latvala was in Tallahassee before these allegations came up? How powerful was he? How important was he to West Pasco and Northern Pinellas County, talk about a little bit about his reputation.
Oh, sure. I mean, Jack is someone that I know pretty well, I would like to say. And he's probably one of the most powerful people in this region, very important to Pinellas County and South Pasco, but more importantly, one of the last remaining moderates that you have in Florida politics. You know, find me another Republican that has stood on the side and championed public schools and actually supported public unions. Jack happened to be that guy. So, you know, the accusations and everything that's come out has been pretty surprising. And, you know, my hope for him is that people will, you know, not forget about the good things that he did in his time in Tallahassee.
So in terms of, you know, advocating for this area, for the Tampa Bay area up there, now without Latvala, what position does that put the Tampa Bay area in Tallahassee?
Tampa Bay is still in a strong position. I mean, you have a lot of leaders here. Wilton Simpson is in line to become the Senate president. Dana Young is rumored to be one of the candidates for the 2020 Senate presidency. And, of course, you have Bill Galvano, who's about to take over from the Bradenton area, not to mention Chris Sprawls over on the other side of the bay. So we're still in a very strong position.
Okay. You know, Latvala has been in politics so long, Adam. He had so many friends that he was able to amass this war chest, this giant war chest. What happens to that money now? I think it was like $4.8 million that he has in his political committee.
Well, that is a $4.8 million question that a lot of people are having. Jack Latvala is not a shrinking violet, yeah. And, you know, he can use that money to go after, to settle scores. That would be fitting for him, but the kind of thing he would do. I mean, one thing I would say is everybody who knows Jack Latvala, whether you liked him or disliked him, knew he was could be a jerk of the first order, could be a bully, but they also knew he was a giant in the legislature. And as Ed says, he was a moderate who could really get things done or block things. Mm-hmm. So if you're concerned about charter schools, if you're on the other side of, if you really support the expansion of charter schools, you got to be thrilled that Jack Latvala's gone. If you very much want to see public employees get better benefits or pay, you're going to be thrilled that Jack Latvala's gone. That said, you know, personally, I was floored that the extent of these allegations and how awful they were and the credible evidence and what he can do with that money, we'll see. Whether he's so damaged that he just gives it away or what he does.
Now, there's a lot of talk about who replaces him, and I didn't mean to interrupt, Amy, but who does replace him? Is there going to be a special election right away, or do they wait till November to have a special election? And who are some of the people that are being touted as possible replacements for Latvala?
I mean, that's up to the governor. He's got to call a special election, and frankly, that can't get done before the session is over. I mean, even if he did it today, we wouldn't have somebody in office before the session. And then there's really no hurry, because there's not much, you know, there's not much to get done after the session before the election. But I expect there'll be an election. I just don't think it'll come immediately.
Danny, is that a solidly Republican seat in your mind, or do you think that the Democrats have some rising influence in Western Pasco and Northern Pinellas?
Well, I think if we look at the case of Andrew Warren, we understand that there's nothing that's ever to be taken for granted. So if you hustle and you get to your base and you do the right things, Andrew showed that you could take out a very solid position in Mark Ober, for example. So if you take that for granted, that that's a Republican seat, I think you are you're selling yourself a little bit short, and then you're just going to give that away.
I do think generally that's viewed as a safe Republican seat.
It is.
If this were the Jeff Brandis seat or the Dana Young seat, it would be. Those are very competitive districts, but that one is pretty solidly Republican.
So are there any Republican names being touted as somebody that might want to run for that seat, and any Democrats being touted as might want to run for that seat?
You know, you would say Chris Sprawls, but he's in line to become Speaker of the House, so that's so going to make a lot more sense for him to do that.
Yeah. He'd be giving up a lot for that.
Yeah, and don't forget Ed Hooper, who has a war chest of about $350,000 right now.
And he had served in the legislature before.
Big ally of Latvala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also the suggestion that Amanda Murphy will step up from Pasco
could
to run for that seat in the Senate.
Anybody from the Pinellas County Commission whose names are being bandied about that...
No. You know, everybody always sees Ken Welch as a candidate for something, as a strong candidate for something, but He's got to strap on his big boy pants and finally make the move for something if he's going to do it.
And he doesn't live in that district as far as I know.
Oh, that's true. He lives in St. Petersburg.
Well, he's now the chair of the Pinellas County Commission as well, so I seriously doubt that Commissioner Walsh would make that jump from that position.
All right. Well, House Speaker Richard Corcoran, who is a critic of government excess and portrays himself as a champion of the little guy, is living large as a result of special interest money.
The Tampa Bay Times reported this week on the lavish lifestyle led by the Pasco County Republican. Among the findings, an $8,000 dinner tab at a Napa Valley restaurant, more than $400,000 for charter planes, another $50,000 spent at high-end steakhouses, and $1,000 for cufflinks. The money comes from donors to the Florida Republican Party, including a myriad of businesses from utilities and insurance and healthcare companies to agricultural interests and state contractors. Corcoran defends the expenses, saying the party has been successful winning elections, and it's all part of the process to continue that success.
So, Adam, you wrote that story along with Elliot Zhang at the Times. I didn't know anybody wore cufflinks these days. $1,000 for cufflinks?
These are $2,000. But, you know, I'm no cheapskate.
All right, so people do. But tell us, fill in the story, though, that Corcoran, this is not a violation of the law.
No, and we're not talking about taxpayer money, which would everybody would agree would be worse. But for the guy who's got an image of Mr. Ethics, Mr. Anti- special interests, it's certainly at best a contradiction that he so eagerly spends this money on, you know, Morton Steakhouse. He practically seems to live at the Capitol Grill in Tampa at West Shore. You know, goes to the French Laundry restaurant that may or may not be the greatest restaurant in the world in California. That's not how your little guy lives, and that's not a guy who seems like he's in touch with the little guy.
But is he working on campaign issues when he goes to the Capitol Grill or when he goes to the French Laundry?
He would argue that it takes money to raise money, and that these donors don't expect to be wined and dined. I would argue that that's hogwash. That these donors, as he well knows, are looking to get something in the legislature, and if the Speaker of the House says, please give me a $50,000 check, they would show up at Burger King. They don't need to show up at the French Laundry. They want to have as much time with them as possible, so they go on these junkets to New York City and the Boca Grande and Napa Valley. But he would argue this is all in the name of electing Republicans.
Are these all interests that have business before the legislature?
Pretty much all. Yeah. Now, he won't identify, say, well, who was eating with you at the French Laundry or at the Gramercy Tavern in New York? Great restaurant. He won't say who was there. But, these aren't, you're not going to California to meet with a California business, which you might assume. These are Florida lobbyists. These are lobbyists for utilities and business interests in Florida that want to have that quality personal time with powerful legislators.
Danny, is this the way things are done, or is this unusual? How would you characterize this?
Well, this is definitely an extension of business as usual, whether it's Democrat or Republican. You see it happening all the time. Adams has done a good job uncovering this. Very thankfully, not taxpayer money. Glad to see. Is it how it's done? I would disagree a little bit. With Adam. McDonald's would not get you a $50,000 check, but you show up at Capitol Grill and people might come off their wallets just a little bit easier. It's what they're accustomed to. It's the style that they're used to. So I don't blame him for wanting to mimic that, to maybe loosen up some wallets to get his agenda done. But am I surprised? I'm not surprised. This is business as usual.
Let me ask you all a tough question, because last segment we were talking about sexual favors being traded for a political vote. Aren't we talking about money here in this case being given to somebody like Jack Latvala, where a utility company or an insurance company wants to have interest in the legislature? And we know that trading sex for votes is wrong. This is money for votes, but this is not against the law in the state of Florida.
Absolutely. It is, ever since they've opened it up, everyone has their own committee, unlimited donations. I mean, it is just the wild, wild west in terms of what's possible. And absolutely, it is a trade for favor.
For interest. And Ed, I mean, you've been up there, going back to your experience in the legislature. How much influence do donors and lobbyists have up there over the process in Tallahassee?
Well, I would slightly disagree with what's been shared here. If you're fair as a legislator, you're going to hear from all sides of an issue, whether somebody's writing you a check for the maximum contribution amount or they haven't written you a check at all. And a lot of times you have competing interests. I'll give you an example. Last year, before the legislature, was the Whiskeys and Wheaties bill. And you had, you know, some smaller business, independent businesses that had their own political committee set up. And you had some of the larger corporations that had their committee set up. If you look at the key players in that debate, they gave to both sides. So basically, it was more of an access thing than anything else. I don't think you could say, well, you know, this company has given to this legislator, so they're going to vote this way. It actually, you know, provides a little bit greater access, which is unfortunate for the regular citizen who travels up to Tallahassee. That's the person I've always felt the worst for, you know, because you're on a limited schedule. And the legislator has to really make the time to sit down with a constituent when they come up there, when you have a lot of competing interests in such a short time frame.
Mm-hmm. Rob, you know, the reality, as I see it, is you want to start laying a little bit of blame. This two-year election cycle puts a pressure on a good guy like Ed or a Chris Sprouse, who's just there to do the right thing, right? But if we're going to we need more than 2 years to actually effectuate any change. So the second they get elected, they're opening their books right up the very next day. And so does it make it easier if we get one $5,000 check than a couple 100s? Absolutely. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying that's the best policy, but we really have to look at, you know, a cause and effect relationship. Does that mean I got to go to Capitol Grill to get a $50,000 check? That's not what I'm saying. Yeah. But I don't think in any way, for a uber majority of our state reps and elected officials, this buys access, or this buys your agenda, I should say. It might give you a little bit of time that you couldn't have gotten before, but that's up to each individual.
Here's what I would say, and I would agree with both of you that probably 75% of the legislators are, you know, trying to be fair, trying to represent their constituents. But people go up to Ed, you're not one of them, but people go up to Tallahassee and they get in this bubble where lobbyists suck up to them constantly. And both these stories are the same of, you know, of people buying $8,000 dinners and feeling like they can treat female lobbyists like any way they want to. These are people that are so out of touch and so spoiled and basically corrupted by this process, they've lost absolute touch with the people back home.
Well, and that's the question I have is, all right, the $5,000 check or $1,000 check, but how big of a check? If you're a child and you need medical care, you're not writing a check. Or if you're an environmentalist, that's right, and you're trying to save the stream down the road from your house, you can't write a check. That's right. Or if you're a consumer and you're trying to fight an increase in utility rates, you can't afford the $5,000 check, right?
Yeah. And what you'll find is the better legislators, which is the majority. I mean, I hate to take the minority and make them the norm, because they're not. This is a part-time position, and most of those legislators, they go up there, they serve their constituents very well. It's just, unfortunately, we hear the bad stories. They do take the time, I know I did, to meet with constituents when I was there, both at home in the office and in Tallahassee.
So even if they didn't write a check, you would spend time with them?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. All right. Well, Florida's two U.S. senators were divided this week on the GOP tax bill.
Republican Senator Marco Rubio had been opposed, but he voted for it after getting an assurance that there would be a $300 increase in the refundable part of the child tax credit. His vote helped Republicans pass the package. Democrat Bill Nelson opposed the bill, saying the corporate tax cuts give an incentive for companies to continue moving jobs overseas where wages are low.
Right now, under current law, corporations that send jobs overseas have to pay taxes on the money that they bring back into the U.S. But now, what this new GOP tax bill says is corporations that send jobs overseas can bring the money back U.S. tax-free. Once this bill passes, companies will come under increasing pressure to take advantage of the tax savings in the bill by sending their jobs overseas to low-wage countries, particularly those jobs that can't already be automated.
So, Danny, let me ask you to go out on a limb. A year from now, as we're looking back at the passage of this tax bill, who do you think is going to be right? Will we look at Rubio's vote as being the right vote or Nelson's vote as being the right vote?
I think you're going to look back, and it's going to depend on the popularity of the president and what people are feeling in their pocketbooks. If the economy is doing well, people will say, well, maybe this was a good thing. I personally don't believe that wholeheartedly that it's a good thing for the American worker or the American taxpayer. To drop the corporate rate from 35% to 21% is a great thing for good companies. And what I mean by good companies are the ones that are going to reinvest that money in infrastructure, in hiring, in improving wages. But what we've seen over the last 30 years is, unfortunately, whenever there's a tax decrease for corporations, the money gets sent overseas. To the senator's point, if he is correct, I think you'll see him sail right back into the U.S. Senate. But if for some reason he's wrong and the economy is doing better than it's ever done, people tend to vote their pocketbooks and it could present an opening for an opponent.
Danny, what do you think? A year from now, will Rubio have been proved right or Nelson?
A year from now,
right?
No one will care. No one will remember. We'll be worrying about the latest tweet and whatever's going on at that moment. it's just the way it is, especially when it comes to taxes. The minute we started talking about taxes, I think our viewership just went down like 15%. When we look at Mr. Nelson's idea about the money going away, I think the incentive is to bring the corporations back. It's a huge jump. 35 to 21 is gargantuan. We were the second highest corporate tax rate. Now we're slam in the middle with the American worker and the American ingenuity plus the American market. It's a big, really, really big deal. During the Clinton administration, they were trying to figure out ways how to bring more money in. And they did study after study. One of them showed a poll of CEOs that had already gone overseas. They're like, if you dropped it to less than 30%, we're on our way back, right? So let's see. Fingers crossed. I believe in that. I'm a business attorney. This is my world. So I'm actually very excited about that drop. It actually changes the analysis now if you're going to be a corporation or an LLC, because the tax benefit is actually lower than the personal income tax rate. So a lot of stuff in this tax cut.
Amy?
People might not care a year from now, because if you look at the charts, almost everybody is going to get, there are tax breaks, no matter how small they are, pretty much across the board. But if you look at the analysis in the outer years going out to 2027, it flips. And I mean, it's already proportionate to the wealthy and who gets the tax breaks. But when it goes to 2027, there's increases on all the lower tax brackets and still a cut for the higher tax brackets. And it's just, it doesn't even out when you look at the later years.
The 2027 is a long way away. I mean, if people are going to be voting in 2018.
It'll be here quicker than you think. When you go back to the Bush tax cuts and think about the fights we had about those when they started to expire and how things change. I mean, right now we're just trying to keep the government running and get a big victory for the president. But this is a gargantuan piece of legislation that's going to affect a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, why couldn't other countries just decide, well, if the U.S. lowered its corporate tax rate, we'll lower ours, and we get a bidding war around the world? I mean, I think we're acting like no other country is going to react to what we do in the U.S.
You know, I think most of the Democrats, maybe not Bernie Sanders, but most of the Democrats were fine and happy in agreeing that the corporate tax rate needed to be raised, lowered. But they weren't happy with all of the sort of giveaways and perks to the wealthiest people. They weren't happy with sunsetting all of the tax breaks that went for middle income people, not sunsetting the ones that went to the higher end people, so that in come 2027, it's the Social Security, Medicare, that kind of funding that's going to be jeopardized.
Yeah.
And it's also striking, speaking of how things change, remember when the Republican Party cared about deficits? Right. I mean, that seems like another world now. This is a huge deficit.
Oh, that's so 2010.
All right, so we got to come back in a year and find out whether or not people are even paying attention to this issue. I want to bring you two guys back and have a discussion about that. Well, more than 200,000 Puerto Ricans fled to Florida after this summer's hurricanes, and their federal housing aid could soon run out.
That's led to calls for Washington to provide more aid. Already, Congress has passed billions to help the recovery from the series of hurricanes this summer that devastated parts of the Caribbean, including the U.S. territories of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Recovery and rebuilding continues in Texas, the Florida Keys, and parts of South Florida. Tens of thousands of Puerto Rican kids have been enrolled in Florida's public schools as the problems caused by the hurricanes echo into 2018. Meantime, some reports say the death toll in Puerto Rico may have been undercounted and that it may actually be as high as 1,000 people.
Danny, this is going to have to be a quick segment. Do you think that the Puerto Rican influx is going to change the nature of Florida politics in the 2018 election?
Well, I'll put it this way. If you aren't thinking about Puerto Ricans and you're in politics, you are wrong with a capital W. It's a fact. They are changing the landscape. They don't need to become citizens. They are citizens. So they come here ready to rock and roll. And if you're not paying attention to them, you're wrong. Look at what Rick Scott did. He sent FHP troopers. He's with the Puerto Rican governor all the time. Really, really smart moves to pay attention to them and then the incoming Venezuelans as well. But Puerto Ricans, we don't need to do anything. They can vote now. So if it might not be an impact on this next cycle, but we're sowing the seeds now that this party or that party loves you, cares about you, is there for you, and they care about your issues. If you're a politician, you better be paying attention.
All right. Before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Ed, let's start with you.
I think 2018, I mean, we're less than a few weeks away, and I think the landscape politically is going to shift. We've seen this, you know, in local politics in the past. It could be somebody making a resignation or, unfortunately, a death, and that one domino could trigger a lot. I don't think that any of our cabinet races are solidified. I think you're going to see some surprise contenders show up as early as January.
You're not ready to make any announcement about your future here, are you?
No, husband and father.
Okay. Danny, your other big story.
That's a shame. Lawrence McClure just won his election. I'm interested in seeing what he's going to do. Quasi outsider from the Plant City area, but he's really solid in his thinking, and he's really, really ready to rock and roll, so I'm excited to see what he's doing.
All right. Amy, your other big story.
Still paying attention to Congress. Like I say, they're trying to keep the government open. There's still a lot of work to do. This is a pretty big week this week, passing of the tax cut legislation, but it'll be interesting to see does this turn into any momentum for getting anything else done as we go into 2018.
The Republicans seem pretty fired up.
They do.
All right. Adam, your other big story.
I think the departure that people care about far more than Jack Latfella's Evan Longoria leaving the Rays. Yeah, that's a big blow. Great guy, great player. It's a huge loss.
Yeah, and so it's going to be rebuilding, rebuilding, rebuilding for the next few years. Oh, man. Okay. Well, thank you all for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week.
And that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And my guests on that program, Amy Holyfield and Adam Smith, both writers for the Tampa Bay Times. Danny Alvarez was the Republican on that panel, and Ed Narain was the Democrat on that panel. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far in the show, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Our email address, if you want to send in a message, send it to dj@wmnf.org. Of course, we talked about the influx of new Puerto Rican residents to Florida who may impact Florida politics for a long time. Jack Latvala's resignation from the Florida Senate, the big spending ways of House Speaker Richard Corcoran in Tallahassee, and the tax plan, the different votes taken by Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio on the tax plan. We'll see where that goes. 813-239-9663. Les writes this. He says, of the first guest on the show today, Kevin Gibbons of the group Health Access Connect, Les writes this, if everyone in the world would give up their personal wants and needs and give to others, the world would be a much better place. Thanks to Kevin for making a difference, writes Les in Brooksville. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Jan Simpson is our producer on the show, and you'll talk to her. She's the first one you'll hear when you call, 813-239-9663. I saw this teaser for the upcoming Dave Chappelle special on Netflix that I think goes online in the next few days. Dave Chappelle, the comedian, for a long time had a show on Comedy Central, which was really a groundbreaking show. Dave lives in Southwest Ohio, which is a really interesting place. And he's in his upcoming special, Dave talks about voting, getting in line and voting in Southwest Florida. Really interesting part of the country. And so let's listen to just a teaser for Dave Chappelle's upcoming special. Here he's talking about getting in line and voting in Southwest Florida in in the 2016 presidential election.
I must tell you, I've never had a problem with white people ever in my life. But full disclosure, the poor whites are my least favorites. We've gotten a lot of trouble out of them. And I've never seen so many of them up close. I looked them right in their coal-smeared faces. And to my surprise, you know what I didn't see? I didn't see one deplorable face in that group. I saw some angry faces and some determined faces, but they felt like decent folk. No, they did. In fact, I'm not even lying, and I didn't sound f***ed up, but I felt sorry for them. I know the game now. I know that rich white people call poor white people trash. And the only reason I know that is because I made so much money last year, the rich whites told me they say it at a cocktail party. And I'm not with that shit. And I stood with them in line, like all of us Americans are required to do in a democracy. Nobody skips the line to vote. And I listened to them. I listened to them say naive, poor white people things. Man, Donald Trump's gonna go to Washington and he's gonna fight for us. I'm standing there thinking in my mind, you dumb mother. You are poor. He's fighting for me.
Now, that was comedian Dave Chappelle, who made millions doing comedy over the last 20 or 25 years, standing in line voting with working-class white people in Southwest Ohio and talking about his experience. That's part of the new special, the Dave Chappelle special that's coming up. Our phone number again, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. We'll open up the phone lines for a few minutes. Les writes this again. Here's the second time Les wrote this morning. He says, regarding the discussion about sexual harassment, he says, males in the animal world always seek dominance over females. He writes, humans are animals and that will never change. Human intelligence has changed our behavior. I'm not condoning men who abuse women in any way, but there is a fine land in the sand. I think he means line in the sand. What is acceptable and what isn't? To avoid accusations, if you are physically attracted to a woman in your workplace, avoid her. Never compliment a woman regarding her appearance. Never ask a woman out after hours, and never touch her ever. Treat her like any other guy in the office, but avoid Trump locker room talk. Women in the office are a threat and will accuse you of anything, writes Les. He goes on to say, of anything to benefit them financially or in the corporate structure. Males in the workplace need to wise up. Well, that's Les's email from cyberspace talking about the ongoing sexual harassment news. And again, if you want to call in with your thoughts, our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And we can talk about the group that we talked about at the top of the show, Health Access Connect, which is providing health care for people in rural parts of Uganda. And we can also talk about the stories covered on Florida this week, including the Jack Latvala resignation, Richard Corcoran's spending, the tax plan, and the influx of 200,000 Puerto Ricans to Florida. And also the Dave Chappelle comments there made about white working class voters. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Alex, who's in Dunedin. We're going to try to pick up Alex in just a second here. Let's see if we can get Alex in Dunedin. Alex, you're on MNF. What would you like to comment about? All right. And Alex hung up. 813-239-9663. And let's go to David. And David is in Palm Harbor. So let's see what David has to say. Hi, David. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Oh, Well, let me get you off my speaker here. Hold on. Let me get out.
There's that. How's that?
Okay, sounds good.
8-1.
Okay. Just in response to the whole workplace and the sexual harassment and Lester's comment, reminds me of an argument I had with my guitar player. He was lamenting the end of flirtation. And I just thought, you know, how blind and self-indulgent that is from a male perspective. I want to put it into context, right, that 1 in 5 women will be raped in their life. And the prime reason, at least it was a little while ago, I don't think it's changed, for visits to the emergency room of women in their between 16 and maybe 40, right, is being beaten by their lover.
Wow.
So, you know, here's some guys lamenting, oh, God, I got to live in fear that my innocent thing will be taken in the wrong way. Meanwhile, over here.
Well, David, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but thanks a lot for calling in. It's a good point, and we should have a much longer discussion about that. This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for your hero, Mark Biro, coming up next.